pipe. I sputtered, trying to gulp enough air to shout, but the airway was blocked.
When you act like a child, you force me to treat you like one.
Sean said this loudly. He almost shouted it. He was saying it to me, but he was not saying it for me. He was saying it for Mother, to define the moment. I was a misbehaving child. He was setting the child right. The pressure on my windpipe eased, and I felt a delicious fullness in my lungs. He knew I would not call out.
Knock it off!
Mother hollered from the kitchen, though I wasn't sure whether she meant Sean or me.
Yelling is rude, Sean said, again speaking to the kitchen. You'll stay down until you apologize.
I said I was sorry for yelling at him. A moment later, I was standing. I folded napkins from paper towels and put one at each setting. When I placed one at Sean's plate, he again jabbed his finger into my ribs. I said nothing. Charles arrived early. Dad hadn't even come in from the junkyard yet, and sat at the table across from Sean, who glared at him, never blinking. I didn't want to leave them alone together, but Mother needed help with the cooking, so I returned to the stove, but devised small errands to bring me back to the table. On one of those trips, I heard Sean telling Charles about his guns, and on another, about all the ways he could kill a man. I laughed loudly at both, hoping Charles would think they were jokes. The third time I returned to the table, Sean pulled me onto his lap. I laughed at that, too. The charade couldn't last, not even until supper. I passed Sean carrying a large china plate of dinner rolls, and he stabbed my gut so hard it knocked the wind out of me. I dropped the plate. It shattered.
Why did you do that?
I shouted. It happened so quickly, I don't know how he got me to the floor, but again I was on my back and he was on top of me. He demanded that I apologize for breaking the plate. I whispered the apology, quietly, so Charles wouldn't hear, but this enraged Sean. He grabbed a fistful of my hair, again near the scalp, for leverage, and yanked me upright, then dragged me toward the bathroom. The movement was so abrupt, Charles had no time to react. The last thing I saw as my head hurled down the hall was Charles leaping to his feet, eyes wide, face pale. My wrist was folded, my arm twisted behind my back. My head was shoved into the toilet so that my nose hovered above the water. Sean was yelling something, but I didn't hear what. I was listening for the sound of footsteps in the hall, and when I heard them, I became deranged. Charles could not see me like this. He could not know that for all my pretenses, my makeup, my new clothes, my china place settings, this is who I was. I convulsed, arching my body and ripping my wrist away from Sean. I'd caught him off guard. I was stronger than he'd expected, or maybe just more reckless, and he lost his hold. I sprang for the door. I'd made it through the frame and had taken a step into the hallway when my head shot backward. Sean had caught me by the hair, and he yanked me toward him with such force that we both tumbled back and into the bathtub. The next thing I remember, Charles was lifting me, and I was laughing. A shrill, demented howl. I thought if I could just laugh loudly enough, the situation might still be saved, that Charles might yet be convinced it was all a joke. Tears streamed from my eyes. My big toe was broken, but I kept cackling. Sean stood in the doorway, looking awkward.
Are you okay? Charles kept saying.
Of course I am. Sean is so, so, so funny. My voice strangled on the last word as I put weight on my foot and a wave of pain swept through me. Charles tried to carry me, but I pushed him off and walked on the brake, grinding my teeth to stop myself from crying out while I slapped playfully at my brother. Charles didn't stay for supper. He fled to his Jeep, and I didn't hear from him for several hours. Then he called and asked me to meet him at the church. He wouldn't come to Buck's Peak. We sat in his Jeep in the dark, empty parking lot. He was crying.
You didn't see what you thought you saw, I said.
If someone had asked me, I'd have said Charles was the most important thing in the world to me.
but he wasn't, and I would prove it to him. What was important to me wasn't love or friendship, but my ability to lie convincingly to myself, to believe I was strong. I could never forgive Charles for knowing I wasn't. I became erratic, demanding, hostile. I devised a bizarre and ever-evolving rubric by which I measured his love for me, and when he failed to meet it, I became paranoid. I surrendered to rages, venting all my savage anger, every fearful resentment I'd ever felt toward Dad or Sean at him, this bewildered bystander who'd only ever helped me. When we argued, I screamed that I never wanted to see him again, and I screamed it so many times that one night, when I called to change my mind, like I always did, he wouldn't let me. We met one final time, in a field off the highway. Buck's Peak loomed over us. He said he loved me, but this was over his head. He couldn't save me. Only I could. I had no idea what he was talking about. Winter covered campus in thick snow. I stayed indoors, memorizing algebraic equations, trying to live as I had before, to imagine my life at the university as disconnected from my life on Buck's Peak. The wall separating the two had been impregnable. Charles was a hole in it. The stomach ulcers returned, burning and aching through the night. Once I awoke to Robin shaking me. She said I'd been shouting in my sleep. I touched my face and it was wet. She wrapped me in her arms so tight I felt cocooned. The next morning, Robin asked me to go with her to a doctor. For the ulcers, but also for an x-ray of my foot, because my big toe had turned black. I said I didn't need a doctor. The ulcers would heal, and someone had already treated the toe. Robin's eyebrow rose. Who? Who treated it? I shrugged. She assumed my mother had, and I let her believe it. The truth was, the morning after Thanksgiving, I had asked Sean to tell me if it was broken. He'd knelt on the kitchen floor, and I dropped my foot into his lap. In that posture, he seemed to shrink. He examined the toe for a moment. Then he looked up at me, and I saw something in his blue eyes. I thought he was about to say he was sorry. But just when I expected his lips to part, he grasped the tip of my toe and yanked. It felt as if my foot had exploded, so intense was the shock that shot through my leg. I was still trying to swallow spasms of pain when Sean stood, put a hand on my shoulder, and said,
"Sorry, Siddle Lister, but it hurts less if you don't see it coming."
A week after Robin asked to take me to the doctor, I again awoke to her shaking me. She gathered me up and pressed me to her, as if her body could hold me together, could keep me from flying apart. "I think you need to see the bishop," she said the next morning. "I'm fine," I said, making a cliche of myself the way not fine people do. "I just need sleep." Soon after, I found a pamphlet for the university counseling service on my desk. I barely looked at it, just knocked it into the trash. I could not see a counselor. To see one would be to ask for help, and I believed myself invincible. It was an elegant deception, a mental pirouette. The toe was not broken because it was not breakable. Only an x-ray could prove otherwise. Thus, the x-ray would break my toe. My algebra final was swept up in this superstition. In my mind, it acquired a kind of mystical power. I studied with the intensity of the insane, believing that if I could best this exam, win that impossible, perfect score, even with my broken toe and without Charles to help me, it would prove that I was above it all, untouchable. The morning of the exam, I limped to the testing center and sat in the drafty hall. The test was in front of me. The problems were compliant, pliable. They yielded to my manipulations, forming into solutions, one after the other. I handed in my answer sheet, then stood in the frigid hallway, staring up at the screen that would display my score. When it appeared, I blinked, and blinked again. 100. A perfect score. I was filled with an exquisite numbness. I felt drunk with it and wanted to shout at the world, "Here's the proof. Nothing touches me." Buck's Peak looked the way it always did at Christmas, a snowy spire adorned with evergreens, and my eyes, increasingly accustomed to brick and concrete, were nearly blinded by the scale and clarity of it. Richard was in the forklift as I drove up the hill, moving a stack of purlins for the shop Dad was building in Franklin, near town. Richard was 22 and one of the smartest people I knew, but he lacked a high school diploma. As I passed him in the drive, it occurred to me that he'd probably be driving that forklift for the rest of his life. I'd been home for only a few minutes when Tyler called.
"I'm just checking in," he said, "to see if Richard is studying for the ACT.
"He's gonna take it?"
"I don't know," Tyler said. "Maybe. Dad and I have been working on him."
"Dad?" Tyler laughed.
"Yeah, Dad. He wants Richard to go to college."
I thought Tyler was joking until an hour later when we sat down to dinner. We'd only just started eating when Dad, his mouth full of potatoes, said,
"Richard, I'll give you next week off, paid, if you'll use it to study them books."
I waited for an explanation. It was not long in coming.
"Richard is a genius," Dad told me a moment later, winking. "He's 5 times smarter than that Einstein was. He can disprove all them socialist theories and godless speculations. He's gonna get down there and blow up the whole damn system."
Dad continued with his raptures, oblivious to the effect he was having on his listeners. Sean slumped on a bench, his back against the wall, his face tilted toward the floor. To look at him was to imagine a man cut from stone, so heavy did he seem, so void of motion. Richard was the miracle son, the gift from God, the Einstein to disprove Einstein. Richard would move the world. Sean would not. He'd lost too much of his mind when he'd fallen off that pallet. One of my father's sons would be driving the forklift for the rest of his life, but it wouldn't be Richard. Richard looked even more miserable than Sean. His shoulders hunched and his neck sank into them, as if he were compressing under the weight of Dad's praise. After Dad went to bed, Richard told me that he'd taken a practice test for the ACT. He'd scored so low, he wouldn't tell me the number.
"Apparently I'm Einstein," Richard said, his head in his hands. "What do I do? Dad is saying I'm going to blow this thing out of the water, and I'm not even sure I can pass."
Every night was the same. Through dinner, Dad would list all the false theories of science that his genius son would disprove. Then, after dinner, I would tell Richard about college, about classes, books, professors, things I knew would appeal to his innate need to learn. I was worried. Dad's expectations were so high, and Richard's fear of disappointing him so intense, it seemed possible that Richard might not take the ACT at all. The shop in Franklin was ready to roof, so 2 days after Christmas, I forced my toe, still crooked and black, into a steel-toed boot, then spent the morning on a roof driving threading screws into galvanized tin. It was late afternoon when Sean dropped his screw gun and shimmied down the loader's extended boom.
"Time for a break, Siddleless," he shouted up from the ground. "Let's go into town."
I hopped onto the pallet, and Sean dropped the boom to the ground.
"You drive," he said.
Then he leaned his seat back and closed his eyes. I headed for Stokes. I remember strange details about the moment we pulled into the parking lot. The smell of oil floating up from our leather gloves, the sandpaper feel of dust on my fingertips, and Sean grinning at me from the passenger seat. Through the city of cars, I spy one, a red Jeep. Charles. I pass through the main lot and turn into the open asphalt on the north side of the store, where employees park. I pull down the visor to evaluate myself, noting the tangle the windy roof has made of my hair and the grease from the tin that has lodged in my pores, making them fat and brown.
My clothes are heavy with dirt. Sean sees the red Jeep. He watches me lick my thumb and scrub dirt from my face, and he becomes excited.
Let's go, he says.
I'll wait in the car.
You're coming in, Sean says.
Sean can smell shame. He knows that Charles has never seen me like this, that every day all last summer I rushed home and removed every stain, every smudge, hiding cuts and calluses beneath new clothes and makeup. 100 times Sean has seen me emerge from the bathroom unrecognizable, having washed the junkyard down the shower drain.
You're coming in, Sean says again.
He walks around the car and opens my door. The movement is old-fashioned, vaguely chivalrous. I don't want to, I say.
Don't want your boyfriend to see you looking so glamorous?
He smiles and jabs me with his finger. He is looking at me strangely, as if to say, this is who you are. You've been pretending that you're someone else, someone better, but you are just this. He begins to laugh, loudly, wildly, as if something funny has happened, but nothing has. Still laughing, he grabs my arm and draws it upward, as if he's going to throw me over his back and carry me in fireman style. I don't want Charles to see that, so I end the game. I say flatly, "Don't touch me." What happens next is a blur in my memory. I see only snapshots of the sky flipping absurdly, of fists coming at me, of a strange, savage look in the eyes of a man I don't recognize. I see my hands grasping the wheel, and I feel strong arms wrenching my legs. Something shifts in my ankle, a crack or a pop. I lose my grip. I'm pulled from the car. I feel icy pavement on my back. Pebbles are grinding into my skin. My jeans have slid down past my hips. I'd felt them peeling off me, inch by inch, as Sean yanked my legs. My shirt has risen up, and I look at myself, at my body spread flat on the asphalt, at my bra and faded underwear. I want to cover myself, but Sean has pinned my hands above my head. I lie still, feeling the cold seep into me. I hear my voice begging him to let me go, but I don't sound like myself. I'm listening to the sobs of another girl. I am dragged upward and set on my feet. I claw at my clothing. Then I'm doubled over and my wrist is being folded back, bending, bent as far as it will go and bending still. My nose is near the pavement when the bone begins to bow. I try to regain my balance, to use the strength in my legs to push back, but when my ankle takes weight, it buckles. I scream. Heads turn in our direction. People crane to see what the commotion is. Immediately, I begin to laugh. A wild, hysterical cackle that, despite all my efforts, still sounds a little like a scream.
You're going in, Sean says, and I feel the bone in my wrist crack.
I go with him into the bright lights. I laugh as we pass through aisle after aisle, gathering the things he wants to buy. I laugh at every word he says, trying to convince anyone who might have been in the parking lot that it was all a joke. I'm walking on a sprained ankle, but the pain barely registers. We do not see Charles. The drive back to the site is silent. It's only 5 miles, but it feels like 50. We arrive, and I limp toward the shop. Dad and Richard are inside. I'd been limping before, because of my toe, so my new hobble isn't so noticeable. Still, Richard takes one look at my face, streaked with grease and tears, and knows something is wrong. Dad sees nothing. I pick up my screw gun and drive screws with my left hand, but the pressure is uneven, and with my weight gathered on one foot, my balance is poor. The screws bounce off the painted tin, leaving long, twisting marks like curled ribbons. Dad sends me home after I ruin 2 sheets. That night, with a heavily wrapped wrist, I scratch out a journal entry. I ask myself questions. Why didn't he stop when I begged him? It was like getting beaten by a zombie, I write. Like he couldn't hear me. Sean knocks. I slide my journal under the pillow. His shoulders are rounded when he enters. He speaks quietly. It was a game, he says. He had no idea he'd hurt me until he saw me cradling my arm at the site. He checks the bones in my wrist, examines my ankle. He brings me ice wrapped in a dish towel and says that next time we're having fun, I should tell him if something is wrong. He leaves. I return to my journal. Was it really fun and games, I write. Could he not tell he was hurting me? I don't know. I just don't know. I begin to reason with myself, to doubt whether I had spoken clearly. What had I whispered, and what had I screamed? I decide that if I had asked differently, been more calm, he would have stopped. I write this until I believe it, which doesn't take long because I want to believe it. It's comforting to think the defect is mine, because that means it is under my power. I put away my journal and lie in bed, reciting this narrative as if it is a poem I've decided to learn by heart. I've nearly committed it to memory when the recitation is interrupted. Images invade my mind, of me on my back, arms pressed above my head. Then I'm back in the parking lot. I look down at my white stomach, then up at my brother. His expression is unforgettable, not anger or rage. There is no fury in it, only pleasure, unperturbed. Then a part of me understands, even as I begin to argue against it, that my humiliation was the cause of that pleasure. It was not an accident or side effect. It was the objective. This half-knowledge works in me like a kind of possession, and for a few minutes I'm taken over by it. I rise from my bed, retrieve my journal, and do something I have never done before. I write what happened. I do not use vague, shadowy language as I have done in other entries. I do not hide behind hints and suggestions. I write what I remember. There was one point when he was forcing me from the car that he had both hands pinned above my head and my shirt rose up. I asked him to let me fix it, but it was like he couldn't hear me. He just stared at it like a great big jerk. It's a good thing I'm as small as I am. If I was larger, at that moment, I would have torn him apart.
I don't know what you've done to your wrist, Dad told me the next morning, but you're no good on the crew like that. You might as well head back to Utah.
The drive to BYU was hypnotic. By the time I arrived, my memories of the previous day had blurred and faded. They were brought into focus when I checked my email. There was a message from Sean, an apology. But he'd apologized already, in my room. I had never known Sean to apologize twice. I retrieved my journal, and I wrote another entry, opposite the first, in which I revised the memory. It was a misunderstanding, I wrote. If I'd asked him to stop, he would have. But however I chose to remember it, that event would change everything. Reflecting on it now, I'm amazed by it. Not by what happened, but that I wrote what happened. That from somewhere inside that brittle shell, in that girl made vacant by the fiction of invincibility, there was a spark left. The words of the second entry would not obscure the words of the first. Both would remain, my memories set down alongside his. There was a boldness in not editing for consistency, in not ripping out either the one page or the other. To admit uncertainty is to admit to weakness, to powerlessness, and to believe in yourself despite both. It is a frailty, but in this frailty there is a strength, the conviction to live in your own mind and not in someone else's. I have often wondered if the most powerful words I wrote that night came not from anger or rage, but from doubt. I don't know. I just don't know. Not knowing for certain, but refusing to give way to those who claim certainty, was a privilege I had never allowed myself. My life was narrated for me by others. Their voices were forceful, emphatic, absolute. It had never occurred to me that my voice, might be as strong as theirs. Chapter 23. I'm from Idaho. On Sunday, a week later, a man at church asked me to dinner. I said no. It happened a second time a few days later with a different man. Again, I said no. I couldn't say yes. I didn't want either of them anywhere near me. Word reached the bishop that there was a woman in his flock who was set against marriage. His assistant approached me after the Sunday service and said I was wanted in the bishop's office. My wrist was still tender when I shook the bishop's hand. He was a middle-aged man with a round face and dark, neatly parted hair. His voice was soft like satin. He seemed to know me before I even opened my mouth. In a way, he did. Robin had told him plenty. He said I should enroll in the university counseling service so that one day I might enjoy an eternal marriage to a righteous man. He talked, and I sat, wordless as a brick. He asked about my family. I didn't answer. I had already betrayed them by failing to love them as I should. The least I could do was stay silent.
"Marriage is God's plan," the bishop said. Then he stood. The meeting was over. He asked me to return the following Sunday. I said I would, but knew I wouldn't. My body felt heavy as I walked to my apartment. All my life, I had been taught that marriage was God's will, that to refuse it was a kind of sin. I was in defiance of God. And yet, I didn't want to be. I wanted children, my own family, but even as I longed for it, I knew I would never have it. I was not capable. I could not be near any man without despising myself. I had always scoffed at the word whore. It sounded guttural and outmoded even to me, but even though I silently mocked Sean for using it, I had come to identify with it. That it was old-fashioned only strengthened the association, because it meant I usually only heard the word in connection with myself. Once, when I was 15, after I'd started wearing mascara and lip gloss, Sean had told Dad that he'd heard rumors about me in town, that I had a reputation. Immediately, Dad thought I was pregnant. He should never have allowed those plays in town, he screamed at Mother. Mother said I was trustworthy, modest. Sean said no teenage girl was trustworthy, and that in his experience, those who seemed pious were sometimes the worst of all. I sat on my bed, knees pressed to my chest, and listened to them shout. Was I pregnant? I wasn't sure. I considered every interaction I'd had with a boy, every glance, every touch. I walked to the mirror and raised my shirt, then ran my fingers across my abdomen, examining it inch by inch, and thought, maybe. I had never kissed a boy. I had witnessed birth, but I'd been given none of the facts of conception. While my father and brother shouted, ignorance kept me silent. I couldn't defend myself because I didn't understand the accusation. Days later, when it was confirmed that I was not pregnant, I evolved a new understanding of the word whore, one that was less about actions and more about essence. It was not that I had done something wrong, so much as that I existed in the wrong way. There was something impure in the fact of my being. It's strange how you give the people you love so much power over you, I had written in my journal. But Sean had more power over me than I could possibly have imagined. He had defined me to myself, and there's no greater power than that. I stood outside the bishop's office on a cold night in February. I didn't know what had taken me there. The bishop sat calmly behind his desk. He asked what he could do for me, and I said I didn't know. No one could give me what I wanted, because what I wanted was to be remade. I can help, he said, but you'll need to tell me what's bothering you.
His voice was gentle, and that gentleness was cruel. I wished he would yell. If he yelled, it would make me angry, and when angry, I felt powerful. I didn't know if I could do this without feeling powerful. I cleared my throat, then talked for an hour.
The bishop and I met every Sunday until spring. To me, he was a patriarch with authority over me. But he seemed to surrender that authority the moment I passed through his door. I talked, and he listened, drawing the shame from me like a healer draws infection from a wound. When the semester ended, I told him I was going home for the summer. I was out of money. I couldn't pay rent. He looked tired when I told him that. He said, "Don't go home, Tara. The church will pay your rent." I didn't want the church's money. I'd made the decision. The bishop made me promise only one thing, that I wouldn't work for my father. My first day in Idaho, I got my old job back at Stokes. Dad scoffed, said I'd never earn enough to return to school. He was right, but the bishop had said God would provide a way, and I believed it. I spent the summer restocking shelves and walking elderly ladies to their cars. I avoided Sean. It was easy because he had a new girlfriend, Emily, and there was talk of a wedding. Sean was 28. Emily was a senior in high school. Her temperament was compliant. Sean played the same games with her he'd played with Sadie, testing his control. She never failed to follow his orders, quivering when he raised his voice, apologizing when he screamed at her. That their marriage would be manipulative and violent, I had no doubt, although those words were not mine. They had been given to me by the bishop, and I was still trying to wrest meaning from them. When the summer ended, I returned to BYU with only $2,000. On my first night back, I wrote in my journal, "I have so many bills, I can't imagine how I'm going to pay them, but God will provide either trials for growth or the means to succeed." The tone of that entry seems lofty, high-minded, but in it I detect a whiff of fatalism. Maybe I would have to leave school. That was fine. There were grocery stores in Utah. I would bag groceries, and one day I'd be manager. I was shocked out of this resignation 2 weeks into the fall semester when I awoke one night to a blinding pain in my jaw. I'd never felt anything so acute, so electrifying. I wanted to rip my jaw from my mouth just to be rid of it. I stumbled to a mirror. The source was a tooth that had been chipped many years before, but now it had fractured again, and deeply. I visited a dentist, who said the tooth had been rotting for years. It would cost $1,400 to repair. I couldn't afford to pay half that and stay in school. I called home. Mother agreed to lend me the money, but Dad attached terms. I would have to work for him next summer. I didn't even consider it. I said I was finished with the junkyard, finished for life, and hung up. I tried to ignore the ache and focus on my classes, but it felt as though I were being asked to sit through a lecture while a wolf gnawed on my jaw. I'd never taken another ibuprofen since that day with Charles, but I began to swallow them like breath mints. They helped only a little. The pain was in the nerves, and it was too severe. I hadn't slept since the ache began, and I started skipping meals because chewing was unthinkable. That's when Robin told the bishop. He called me to his office on a bright afternoon. He looked at me calmly from across his desk and said, "What are we going to do about your tooth?" I tried to relax my face. "You can't go through the school year like this," he said. "But there's an easy solution. Very easy, in fact. How much does your father make?" "Not much," I said. "He's been in debt since the boys wrecked all the equipment last year." "Excellent," he said. "I have the paperwork here for a grant. I'm sure you're eligible, and the best part is, you won't have to pay it back." I'd heard about government grants. Dad said that to accept one was to indebt yourself to the Illuminati. "That's how they get you," he'd said. "They give you free money. Then the next thing you know, they own you." These words echoed in my head. I'd heard other students talk about their grants, and I'd recoiled from them. I would leave school before I would allow myself to be purchased. "I don't believe in government grants," I said.
"Why not?"
I told him what my father said. He sighed and looked heavenward.
"How much will it cost to fix the tooth?"
$1,400, I said. "I'll find the money."
"The church will pay," he said quietly. I have a discretionary fund.
That money is sacred. The bishop threw his hands in the air. We sat in silence. Then he opened his desk drawer and withdrew a checkbook. I looked at the heading. It was for his personal account. He filled out a check, to me, for $1,500.
I will not allow you to leave school over this, he said.
The check was in my hand. I was so tempted, the pain in my jaw so savage, that I must have held it for 10 seconds before passing it back. I had a job at the campus creamery, flipping burgers and scooping ice cream. I got by between paydays by neglecting overdue bills and borrowing money from Robin, so twice a month, when a few $100 went into my account, it was gone within hours. I was broke when I turned 19 at the end of September. I had given up on fixing the tooth. I knew I would never have $1,400. Besides, the pain had lessened. Either the nerve had died, or my brain had adjusted to its shocks. Still, I had other bills, so I decided to sell the only thing I had of any value, my horse, Bud. I called Sean and asked how much I could get. Sean said a mixed breed wasn't worth much, but that I could send him to auction like Grandpa's dog food horses. I imagined Bud in a meat grinder, then said, "Try to find a buyer first." A few weeks later, Sean sent me a check for a few $100. When I called Sean and asked who he'd sold Bud to, he mumbled something vague about a guy passing through from Tooele. I was an incurious student that semester. Curiosity is a luxury reserved for the financially secure. My mind was absorbed with more immediate concerns, such as the exact balance of my bank account, who I owed how much, and whether there was anything in my room I could sell for $10 or $20. I submitted my homework and studied for my exams, but I did so out of terror, of losing my scholarship should my GPA fall a single decimal, not from real interest in my classes. In December, after my last paycheck of the month, I had $60 in my account. Rent was $110, due January 7th. I needed quick cash. I'd heard there was a clinic near the mall that paid people for plasma. A clinic sounded like a part of the medical establishment, but I reasoned that as long as they were taking things out, not putting anything in, I'd be okay. The nurse stabbed at my veins for 20 minutes, then said they were too small. I bought a tank of gas with my last $30 and drove home for Christmas. On Christmas morning, Dad gave me a rifle. I didn't take it out of the box, so I have no idea what kind. I asked Sean if he wanted to buy it off me, but Dad gathered it up and said he'd keep it safe. That was it, then. There was nothing left to sell, no more childhood friends or Christmas presents. It was time to quit school and get a job. I accepted that. My brother Tony was living in Las Vegas, working as a long-haul trucker, so on Christmas Day I called him. He said I could live with him for a few months and work at the In-N-Out Burger across the street. I hung up and was walking down the hall, wishing I'd asked Tony if he could lend me the money to get to Vegas, when a gruff voice called to me.
Hey, Siddle Lister, come here a minute.
Sean's bedroom was filthy. Dirty clothes littered the floor, and I could see the butt of a handgun poking out from under a pile of stained T-shirts. The bookshelves strained under boxes of ammo and stacks of Louis L'Amour paperbacks. Sean was sitting on the bed, his shoulders hunched, his legs bowed outward. He looked as if he'd been holding that posture for some time, contemplating the squalor. He let out a sigh, then stood and walked toward me, lifting his right arm. I took an involuntary step back, but he had only reached into his pocket. He pulled out his wallet, opened it, and extracted a crisp $100 bill.
Merry Christmas, he said. You won't waste this like I will.
I believed that $100 was a sign from God. I was supposed to stay in school. I drove back to BYU and paid my rent. Then, because I knew I wouldn't be able to pay it in February, I took a second job as a domestic cleaner, driving 20 minutes north 3 days a week to scrub expensive homes in Draper. The bishop and I were still meeting every Sunday. Robin had told him that I hadn't bought my textbooks for the semester.
This is ridiculous, he said. Apply for the grant. You're poor. That's why these grants exist.
My opposition was beyond rational. It was visceral.
I make a lot of money, the bishop said. I pay a lot of taxes. Just think of it as my money.
He had printed out the application forms, which he gave to me.
Think about it. You need to learn to accept help, even from the government.
I took the forms. Robin filled them out. I refused to send them.
Just get the paperwork together, she said. See how it feels.
I needed my parents' tax returns. I wasn't even sure my parents filed taxes, but if they did, I knew Dad wouldn't give them to me if he knew why I wanted them. I thought up a dozen fake reasons for why I might need them, but none were believable. I pictured the returns sitting in the large gray filing cabinet in the kitchen. Then, I decided to steal them. I left for Idaho just before midnight, hoping I would arrive at around 3 a.m. and the house would be quiet. When I reached the peak, I crept up the driveway, wincing each time a bit of gravel snapped beneath my tires. I eased the car door open noiselessly, then padded across the grass and slipped through the back door, moving silently through the house, reaching my hand out to feel my way to the filing cabinet. I had only made it a few steps when I heard a familiar clink.
"Don't shoot!" I shouted. "It's me!"
"Who?"
I flipped the light switch and saw Sean sitting across the room, pointing a pistol at me. He lowered it.
"I thought you were someone else."
"Obviously," I said. We stood awkwardly for a moment. Then I went to bed. The next morning, after Dad left for the junkyard, I told Mother one of my fake stories about BYU needing her tax returns. She knew I was lying. I could tell because when Dad came in unexpectedly and asked why she was copying the returns, she said the duplicates were for her records. I took the copies and returned to BYU. Sean and I exchanged no words before I left. He never asked why I'd been sneaking into my own house at 3 a.m, and I never asked who he'd been waiting for, sitting up in the middle of the night with a loaded pistol. The forms sat on my desk for a week before Robin walked with me to the post office and watched me hand them to the postal worker. It didn't take long, a week, maybe two. I was cleaning houses in Draper when the mail came, so Robin left the letter on my bed with a note that I was a commie now. I tore open the envelope, and a check fell onto my bed. For $4,000. I felt greedy, then afraid of my greed. There was a contact number. I dialed it. "There's a problem," I told the woman who answered. "The check is for $4,000, but I only need $1,400. The line was silent. "Hello? Hello?" "Let me get this straight," the woman said. "You're saying the check is for too much money? What do you want me to do?" "If I send it back, could you send me another one? I only need $1,400 for a root canal." "Look, honey," she said, "you get that much because that's how much you get. Cash it or don't, it's up to you." I had the root canal. I bought my textbooks, paid rent, and had money left over. The bishop said I should treat myself to something, but I said I couldn't. I had to save the money. He told me I could afford to spend some.
"Remember," he said, "you can apply for the same amount next year."
I bought a new Sunday dress. I'd believed the money would be used to control me, but what it did was enable me to keep my word to myself. For the first time, when I said I would never again work for my father, I believed it. I wonder now if the day I set out to steal that tax return wasn't the first time I left home to go to Buck's Peak. That night I had entered my father's house as an intruder. It was a shift in mental language, a surrendering of where I was from. My own words confirmed it. When other students asked where I was from, I said, "I'm from Idaho," a phrase that, as many times as I've had to repeat it over the years, has never felt comfortable in my mouth. When you are part of a place, growing that moment in its soil, there's never a need to say you're from there. I never uttered the words, "I'm from Idaho," until I'd left it. Chapter 24 A Knight Errant. I had $1,000 in my bank account. It felt strange just to think that, let alone say it. $1,000. Extra. That I did not immediately need. It took weeks for me to come to terms with this fact, but as I did, I began to experience the most powerful advantage of money. The ability to think of things besides money. My professors came into focus, suddenly and sharply. It was as if before the grant, I'd been looking at them through a blurred lens. My textbooks began to make sense, and I found myself doing more than the required reading. It was in this state that I first heard the term bipolar disorder. I was sitting in Psychology 101 when the professor read the symptoms aloud from the overhead screen. Depression, mania, paranoia, euphoria, delusions of grandeur, and persecution. I listened with a desperate interest. "This is my father," I wrote in my notes. "He's describing Dad." A few minutes before the bell rang, a student asked what role mental disorders might have played in separatist movements. "I'm thinking of famous conflicts like Waco, Texas, or Ruby Ridge, Idaho," he said. Idaho isn't famous for many things, so I figured I'd have heard of whatever Ruby Ridge was. He'd said it was a conflict. I searched my memory, trying to recall if I'd ever heard the words. There was something familiar in them. Then images appeared in my mind, weak and distorted, as if the transmission were being disrupted at the source. I closed my eyes, and the scene became vivid. I was in our house, crouching behind the birchwood cabinets. Mother was kneeling next to me, her breath slow and tired. She licked her lips and said she was thirsty. Then, before I could stop her, she stood and reached for the tap. I felt the tremor of gunfire and heard myself shout. There was a thud as something heavy fell to the floor. I moved her arm aside and gathered up the baby. The bell rang. The auditorium emptied. I went to the computer lab. I hesitated for a moment over the keyboard, struck by a premonition that this was information I might regret knowing, then typed Ruby Ridge into the browser. According to Wikipedia, Ruby Ridge was the site of a deadly standoff between Randy Weaver and a number of federal agencies, including the U.S. Marshals Service and the FBI. The name Randy Weaver was familiar. And even as I read it, I heard it falling from my father's lips. Then the story, as it had lived in my imagination for 13 years, began replaying in my mind. The shooting of a boy, then of his father, then of his mother. The government had murdered the entire family, parents and children, to cover up what they had done. I scrolled past the backstory to the first shooting. Federal agents had surrounded the Weaver cabin. The mission was surveillance only, and the Weavers were unaware of the agents until a dog began to bark. Believing the dog had sensed a wild animal, Randy's 14-year-old son, Sammy, charged into the woods. The agents shot the dog, and Sammy, who was carrying a gun, opened fire. The resulting conflict left two dead, a federal agent and Sammy, who was retreating, running up the hill toward the cabin when he was shot in the back. I read on. The next day, Randy Weaver was shot, also in the back, while trying to visit his son's body. The corpse was in the shed, and Randy was lifting the latch on the door when a sniper took aim at his spine and missed. His wife, Vicky, moved toward the door to help her husband, and again the sniper opened fire. The bullet struck her in the head, killing her instantly as she held their 10-month-old daughter. For 9 days, the family huddled in the cabin with their mother's body, until finally negotiators ended the standoff and Randy Weaver was arrested. I read this last line several times before I understood it. Randy Weaver was alive? Did Dad know? I kept reading. The nation had been outraged. Articles had appeared in nearly every major newspaper blasting the government's callous disregard for life. The Department of Justice had opened an investigation, and the Senate had held hearings. Both had recommended reforms to the rules of engagement, particularly concerning the use of deadly force. The Weavers had filed a wrongful death suit for $200 million, but settled out of court when the government offered Vicky's three daughters $1 million each. Randy Weaver was awarded $100,000, and all charges, except two related to court appearances, were dropped. Randy Weaver had been interviewed by major news organizations and had even co-written a book with his daughter. He now made his living speaking at gun shows. If it was a cover-up, it was a very bad one. There had been media coverage, official inquiries, oversight. Wasn't that the measure of a democracy? There was one thing I still didn't understand. Why had federal agents surrounded Randy Weaver's cabin in the first place? Why had Randy been targeted? I remembered Dad saying it could just as easy be us. Dad was always saying that one day the government would come after folks who resisted its brainwashing, who didn't put their kids in school. For 13 years, I'd assumed that this was why the government had come for Randy, to force his children into school. I returned to the top of the page and read the whole entry again, but this time I didn't skip the backstory. According to all the sources, including Randy Weaver himself, the conflict had begun when Randy sold two sawed-off shotguns to an undercover agent he'd met at an Aryan Nations gathering. I read this sentence more than once, many times, in fact. Then I understood. White supremacy was at the heart of this story, not homeschool. The government, it seemed, had never been in the habit of murdering people for not submitting their children to a public education. This seemed so obvious to me now, it was difficult to understand why I had ever believed anything else. For one bitter moment, I thought Dad had lied. Then I remembered the fear on his face, the heavy rattling of his breath, and I felt certain that he'd really believed we were in danger. I reached for some explanation, and strange words came to mind, words I'd learned only minutes before. Paranoia, mania, delusions of grandeur and persecution. And finally, the story made sense. The one on the page, and the one that had lived in me through childhood. Dad must have read about Ruby Ridge, or seen it on the news, and somehow, as it passed through his feverish brain, it had ceased to be a story about someone else, and to become a story about him. If the government was after Randy Weaver, surely it must also be after Jean Westover, who'd been holding the front line in the war with the Illuminati for years. No longer content to read about the brave deeds of others, he had forged himself a helmet and mounted a nag. I became obsessed with bipolar disorder. We were required to write a research paper for psychology, and I chose it as my subject, then used the paper as an excuse to interrogate every neuroscientist and cognitive specialist at the university. I described Dad's symptoms, attributing them not to my father, but to a fictive uncle. Some of the symptoms fit perfectly, others did not. The professors told me that every case is different. "What you're describing sounds more like schizophrenia," one said. "Did your uncle ever get treatment?" "No," I said. "He thinks doctors are part of a government conspiracy."
"That does complicate things," he said.
With all the subtlety of a bulldozer, I wrote my paper on the effect bipolar parents have on their children. It was accusative, brutal. I wrote that children of bipolar parents are hit with double risk factors. First, because they are genetically predisposed to mood disorders, and second, because of the stressful environment and poor parenting of parents with such disorders. In class, I had been taught about neurotransmitters and their effect on brain chemistry. I understood that disease is not a choice. This knowledge might have made me sympathetic to my father, but it didn't. I felt only anger. We were the ones who'd paid for it, I thought. Mother, Luke, Sean, we had been bruised and gashed and concussed, had our legs set on fire and our heads cut open. We had lived in a state of alert, a kind of constant terror, our brains flooding with cortisol because we knew that any of those things might happen at any moment. Because Dad always put faith before safety. Because he believed himself right, and he kept on believing himself right, after the first car crash, after the second, after the bin, the fire, the pallet,
and it was us who paid. I visited Buck's Peak the weekend after I submitted my paper. I had been home for less than an hour when Dad and I got into an argument. He said I owed him for the car. He really only mentioned it, but I became crazed, hysterical. For the first time in my life, I shouted at my father, not about the car, but about the Weavers. I was so suffocated by rage, my words didn't come out as words, but as choking, sputtering sobs. Why are you like this? Why did you terrify us like that? Why did you fight so hard against made-up monsters, but do nothing about the monsters in your own house? Dad gaped at me, astonished. His mouth sagged, and his hands hung limply at his sides, twitching as if he wanted to raise them, to do something. I hadn't seen him look so helpless since he'd crouched next to our wrecked station wagon, watching Mother's face bulge and distend, unable even to touch her because electrified cables were sending a deadly pulse through the metal. Out of shame or anger, I fled. I drove without stopping back to BYU. My father called a few hours later. I didn't answer. Screaming at him hadn't helped. Maybe ignoring him would. When the semester ended, I stayed in Utah. It was the first summer that I didn't return to Buck's Peak. I did not speak to my father, not even on the phone. This estrangement was not formalized. I just didn't feel like seeing him or hearing his voice, so I didn't. I decided to experiment with normality. For 19 years, I'd lived the way my father wanted. Now I would try something else. I moved to a new apartment on the other side of town where no one knew me. I wanted a new start. At church my first week, my new bishop greeted me with a warm handshake, then moved on to the next newcomer. I reveled in his disinterest. If I could just pretend to be normal for a little while, maybe it would feel like the truth. It was at church that I met Nick. Nick had square glasses and dark hair, which he gelled and teased into neat spikes. Dad would have scoffed at a man wearing hair gel, which is perhaps why I loved it. I also loved that Nick wouldn't have known an alternator from a crankshaft. What he did know were books and video games and clothing brands and words. He had an astonishing vocabulary. Nick and I were a couple from the beginning. He grabbed my hand the second time we met. When his skin touched mine, I prepared to fight that primal need to push him away, but it never came. It was strange and exciting, and no part of me wanted it to end. I wished I were still in my old congregation so I could rush to my old bishop and tell him I wasn't broken anymore. I overestimated my progress. I was so focused on what was working, I didn't notice what wasn't. We'd been together a few months, and I'd spent many evenings with his family before I ever said a word about mine. I did it without thinking. Casually mentioned one of Mother's oils when Nick said he had an ache in his shoulder. He was intrigued. He'd been waiting for me to bring them up. But I was angry at myself for the slip and didn't let it happen again. I began to feel poorly toward the end of May. A week passed in which I could hardly drag myself to my job, an internship at a law firm. I slept from early evening until late morning, then yawned through the day. My throat began to ache and my voice dropped, roughening into a deep crackle, as if my vocal cords had turned to sandpaper. At first, Nick was amused that I wouldn't see a doctor. But as the illness progressed, his amusement turned to worry, then confusion. I blew him off. "It's not that serious," I said. "I'd go if it were serious." Another week passed. I quit my internship and began sleeping through the days as well as the nights. One morning, Nick showed up unexpectedly. "We're going to the doctor," he said. I started to say I wouldn't go, but then I saw his face. He looked as though he had a question, but knew there was no point in asking it. The tense line of his mouth, the narrowing of his eyes. This is what distrust looks like, I thought. Given the choice between seeing an evil socialist doctor and admitting to my boyfriend that I believed doctors were evil socialists, I chose to see the doctor. "I'll go today," I said. "I promise. But I'd rather go alone." "Fine," he said. He left, But now I had another problem. I didn't know how to go to a doctor. I called a friend from class and asked if she'd drive me. She picked me up an hour later, and I watched, perplexed, as she drove right